Good evening. Properly wired. Okay. I think I told Patrick, it's Patrick, right? That I would introduce myself. I'm Ed. I'm Edward Brown. And my Buddhist name is Jusan Kaine. It's Longevity Mountain, Peaceful Sea. When Suzuki Roshi ordained me in 1971, he said, you will be like a mountain surrounded by a sea of peaceful people. I guess I need to sit up a little straighter for that. This year I've been thinking a lot about a Rumi poem. I meant to memorize it for you so I could share it with you tonight. I didn't get to it. But I remember the beginning of it. All day I think about it, and at night I say it. Where did I come from? What am I supposed to be doing? Have you had that thought? And he wasn't even a Zen guy, you know. All day I think about it, and at night I say it. Where did I come from? What am I supposed to be doing? I have no idea, he says. And I say, I have no idea. Later in the poem he says, I am like a strange bird from a distant continent sitting in this aviary. So thank you for welcoming me into your aviary. For strange birds. I'm sorry, maybe some of you are not strange birds. If any of you would like to just be ordinary birds, fine. I watched, was last night or the night before, I watched the beginning of a movie about Legoland or something. Have you? Somebody told my partner Margo and I that it was good. We lasted about 10 minutes. In Legoland, everything is awesome. And you go to work and everything is awesome and you do what you're told. And then somehow there's this one Lego man who is special or gets, you know, some secret transmission or something. So, but it was too much for this strange bird to sit through. So I can't tell you the end if you want to know. I'm having a little bit of a problem because I don't know whether to start at the beginning, the middle, or the end. Even though this isn't the end, but it's today, you know. Why don't I start? You know, some of you might wonder what meditation is good for, so I will tell you this story. About 5 or 6 years ago, my computer was beginning to be senile or whatever it's called with computers. And I have a computer, I'm not sure what to call him, you know, doctor, wizard, guru. Anyway, he handles my computer issues. He's coming over on Friday to, we took my Apple and we downloaded Yosemite in place of Lion, and now it's way much slower, so he's going to add some memory on Friday and we'll see what that does. Anyway, he knows what he's doing. I don't. So he said, why don't you go to the Apple store and look around and see if you might want to get an Apple computer. So I got to the store, and in the window of the Apple store, it's in the Corte Madera shopping mall, across from Macy's, and in the window there's a lot of lavender or violet fluff, and it turned out you could get a mini iPod now in purple, emerald green, or blue. Big news, apparently. And I went into the store, and on the right-hand side of the store, there's a giant movie screen, which seemed to have more or less have continuous explosions. And the store was pretty crowded. You know, it's just like 10 o'clock in the morning or something. But there's all kinds of people in the store, and I kind of there's in this energy. A lot of energy in the store, and I kind of have the feeling like, oh my, everybody knows, is in on this, that I'm not in on, and I kind of fiddled around with a couple computers in the front of the store. And in the back of the store, of course, there's the Apple Genius Bar, where you can talk to a genius about your Apple, or an Apple genius. And I actually have a friend of mine who is an Apple genius. I've known him since he was about 4. Long story, we won't go there, but anyway, he's now an Apple genius, among other things. So I started walking towards the back of the store, and I was already overwhelmed by the energy, and then there's these stands and people and the energy, and a woman comes up to me, and she had a name tag. I don't remember what it said, Sherry or something, you know. And she comes up to me and she said, may I help you? And I said, I don't know. I'm really overwhelmed by the energy in the store. A lot of people seem to know what they want and what they're doing here. I don't know. So I don't know if you can help me or not. And she said, have you tried meditation? Well, I didn't want to say, I've been meditating for over 40 years. I guess I'm not a very good student. It hasn't taken... So instead of saying I've been meditating for over 40 years, you know, Malcolm Gladwell says, if you've done something for 10,000 hours, you're a virtuoso. You know, that musicians who growing up practiced for over 10,000 hours, they become tip top of the line. And then if you've played your instrument for 7,000 or 8,000, then you're a professional, and 5 or 6, you can teach, you know, music and whatever. But, you know, I'm up to somewhere around 30,000 hours, and I still don't know what I'm good at, if anything. You know. Yeah. Except for when things burn. Anyway, so instead of saying I've been meditating for over 40 years, I said, a little. How about you? And she said, oh yeah, I've been meditating for 3 years now. And how do you like it? I said, and she said, oh, it's wonderful. I have so much more energy, and I feel so much more together and stable in my life. It's just terrific. So maybe some of you are at that stage. If you are, you know, value it while you can. So I was just thinking about it, you know, and I started this year, 2015, in May will be the 50th anniversary of my beginning to sit. So, and I'm a strange bird from a distant continent, sitting in this strange aviary. Where did I come from? What am I supposed to be doing? And it's not so different, you know, than the old Zen teachers. Later in that poem, Rumi says, "Who is it that sees with my eyes? Who hears with my ears? Who says words with my voice? Who?" This is actually, you know, about the same time as Rumi, or actually earlier in Chinese Zen. Zen masters were saying, use this as a, raise this question to yourself, who? Who is it who's feeling sad? Who feels sad? There are many different kinds of ways to have a little bit of not be so identified with your experience. Because, of course, mostly we tend to identify with our experience, and then we want to know, how does the story come out? And will it come out okay? Or will it always be like this? Can we make it any better? Someone who sits with me, he just got out of rehab. Life is so strange, isn't it? He works for Twitter. Or he was working for Twitter, and it turns out that at Twitter, they work at long tables, apparently, and every group has their own bar that's full with all kinds of beers from all over the world and all kinds of liquors. It's very hard not to drink a lot at Twitter. So my student friend, he went into rehab. And he almost went back to work a week ago Monday, but several people told him not to. Take a few more weeks off. But you work hard, and then you drink hard. You don't have to go home. I mean, anyway, it's a strange world. But anyway, he said, I told him this story about when we first started Tassajara in 1967, and we were sitting zazen in the what's now the guest dining room. While the Zendo, you know, we were converting what was the old Tassajara bar, we were converting that into the Tassajara Zendo. This is not, I'm sorry, you know, my mind goes a lot of different directions. We have a friend, you know, in Europe, Vanya Palmers, who's started a Zen center in Austria, Purig, and now he started this spectacular Zen center in, it's called Felsentor, and it's 1,500 meters above Lake Lucerne. This incredible view across, all across the lake and the villages, and then across the way there's some mountains, and behind those mountains is the Swiss Alps. And it's, his family had a chain of department stores called Palmer's, and they're the Victoria's Secret of Europe. So now the sales of women's lingerie is building Buddhist meditation centers. Isn't that amazing? But so I told this story about when we started, and we were, at that point, we served breakfast and we were serving cereal, and it worked out all right when we had, you know, tables, and at each table we would have milk and sugar. And some people didn't want white sugar, so we had brown sugar. And then some people said, we don't want sugar, we should have honey. And then there were the people who wanted molasses. And in those days, it wasn't milk and non-fat milk and 2% milk and almond milk and rice milk and hazelnut milk and soy milk. It was milk half and half or cream or canned milk. That was a different era. But, you know, you should be able to have your breakfast cereal. You should be able to have it, as, you know, we've heard. You should be able to have it your way. Which is almost like, you know, watch what you want to watch when you want to watch it. This is life, isn't it? Shouldn't you have the experience you want when you want to have it? On demand. Just give us your money. And we will hijack your attention for you. Your attention is very valuable and precious, and usually you don't have somebody pay you for your attention. You pay somebody to take your attention. This is strange, but... So this is interesting what we do in meditation here. You give your attention to something of your own choosing. You come to meditation and you choose to meditate, rather than, I want to be entertained. Anyway, excuse me, I'll try to stay on the subject. But this is the subject. So we had about 7 or 8 things to pass down with the morning cereal. So we first did this in the old, what was the dining room, and we were serving breakfast, and then we had to pass this tray of condiments down the row. And then everybody has to put this on their cereal. And the first day we just had 1 or 2 trays for a whole row of 8 or 10 or 12 people. So then we realized we need a tray for every 3 people. So then we had about 40 containers of milk and cream and sugar and white sugar and brown sugar and honey. And then when you get back to the kitchens, oh my God, now what do we do with all these pitchers and dishes? And so about the second, if not the third morning anyway, we were back in the kitchen and somebody came and said, Roshi wants to give a talk. He wants everybody to be there. You need to come to the Zendo. So we went into the Zendo, and Suzuki Roshi said, I don't understand you Americans. When you put so much milk and sugar on your cereal, how can you taste the true spirit of the grain? I thought, huh? I had never heard of the true spirit of the grain before. And then he said, while I was still thinking about that, he said, what, did you think you would add milk and sugar to every moment of your experience to make it be the way you would like it? I don't think so. Why don't you taste your own true spirit? Why don't you taste the true spirit of the moment? So we were very happy then. We decided when we got back to the kitchen, from now on, roasted sesame seeds and salt. Gomashio. Yeah. So this young man, he's not so young, but anyway, he heard me say this and he thought, I've been doing this all my life. I've been trying to use drugs and alcohol to make the moment better and to have it be more the way I want it to be. And it might be pretty nice, but it would be better if you were a little high or a little more relaxed or a little more, wouldn't it? And can't you just make reality the way you want it? Well, anyway, there are different aspects to reality. I also think, you know, from time to time, in Zen terminology, it's the, you know, one of the most famous sayings in Soto Zen is, mind itself is Buddha. This is very interesting, you know, mind itself is Buddha. Do you suppose it applies to you and your mind, or is that just mind itself and not your mind? And did you suppose your mind is separate from mind itself? How many minds do you think are there? This is... Larry Dossey wrote a book about healing words and about the power of prayer, and he said, scientists are beginning to conclude, many of them, the total number of minds in the universe is one. And that we each have an apparatus for mind, and that we can... We receive from mind. We have our own receptor, and so we, but because nobody showed how stuff could produce consciousness, even though the big emphasis in Western science is on stuff, and of course you know the reason the emphasis is on stuff is because we can talk about it, and we can have evidence. If you're talking about consciousness, then you know, what are you talking about? We want to have things we can measure. And make, you know, statements about. Mind itself is Buddha. This is related to many things, but again, one of the things that we tend to do, in which I will tell you more about tonight. But we think that the experience we're having has something to do with the kind of person we are. So the more we can have spiritual experiences and positive experiences and healing experiences, and you know, it must be that we're a good person and mind itself is Buddha. But what about when things aren't working like that? Is mind itself still Buddha? In other words, to put this in another frame, it's quite common to endeavor to have, you know, I certainly started out, for instance, I thought, I will do spiritual practice, I will become a spiritual person. And if I'm a spiritual person, then... people will love me, respect me, approve of me, because I'm a spiritual person. It never happened. I guess maybe there are people who have been perfect enough at Zen practice. I don't think there are, but you know, some people have aimed to be perfect enough at Zen practice that people look at them like, oh, wow. You are just so perfect. At least you look perfect. You sound perfect. And then you can have disciples who look at your perfectedness, and then you think that if you practice hard enough, you could become perfect like they are. Of course, it's pretty discouraging then when you find out they're not perfect. And there are various ways in which you find this out, and various things happen over the years. But this is the idea, is that you could actually become a better person. You know, we're big on self-improvement, and you could become a better person. And because we also have this idea that the painful things are happening, and it's actually child thinking, the painful things are happening in our life because that's what we deserve. And we deserve it because we must be a bad or imperfect person. That's why these painful things are happening. And if I wasn't such a bad or painful person, I would have better experiences because I would deserve to have better experiences. This is setting aside, of course, what Issan Dorsey at one point said. Issan was one of our students for many years with Suzuki Rishi and died of AIDS many, now 20 years or so ago. But one of the most enjoyable people who's been at Zen Center, because everybody felt comfortable around him. He'd been a female impersonator for 20 years before coming to Zen Center. but he was the best at, you know, somebody came to the door of San Francisco Zen Center and said, I need a place to sleep. And he'd say, come back when you've got it together and sit with us. I thought you were a Zen Center. Yeah, that's right, we're a Zen Center. So you get yourself together, you come back and sit. And the rest of us go, well, we can't just tell people to go away. Isn't going to tell people to go away. Anyway, Issan used to say, everybody gets what they deserve, whether they deserve it or not. But this is an interesting kind of problem we have that, and so we think, I thought, if I become a better person, these painful things won't happen. And when you're a child, and then if you have, and we've all had painful things, some of us more painful than others, but as a child, then you think, if this happened then, it could happen now. How will you keep it from happening now? You'll become a better person. Anyway, is mind itself is Buddha. So is mind itself already Buddha, or do you need to do something? It's a little bit the question between what is Buddha, what is a sentient being. How can you tell the difference? Which mind is which? And the saying in Soto Zen is mind itself is Buddha. Before you do or don't do anything. So in that tradition, our tradition, we don't say, I'm a strange bird from a distant continent sitting in this aviary. I am a Buddha person. You know, I also have, even though I am having these painful experiences, this is the mind of Buddha. And we don't try to think, you know, I could fix this. I could get enough milk and sugar to have it my way. But at the same time, you know, it's a relief to know mind itself is Buddha. This is a kind of grace. And it's a little bit like, in more psychological terms, so I think I'll stop and I will tell you the story. In 1984, just to back up slightly, but in 1983, was what's known variously as, you know, at San Francisco Zen Center, the fall of the empire, or, you know, the apocalypse. But our abbot at the time, Richard Baker, was accused of, you know, to be polite about it, of having affairs with various women who were not his wife, who were students, and in some instances, and in the particular instance that came to light, married to somebody else. I once saw a friend of mine who's a Swami up in Portland, and Swamiji said to me, who's this Richard Baker person? I said, what do you mean, who is he? And he said, well, you know, he called me up and he said, you know, in Zen, we just eat what we're served. You know, it's like going out begging and you eat what's served. So if you're offered food, you just eat what you're offered. You know, that's our tradition. And Swamiji said, I told him, yeah, that may be so, but usually you don't eat the food off of somebody else's plate. referring to the fact that he was having an affair with a woman who was married to somebody else. But anyway, because Baker Rishi wasn't, then went on a leave of absence, and in December, he submitted a letter of resignation. I could tell you a lot more about this, but that's enough. Thank you. And I was invited to lead the fall practice period at Tassajara, 1984. Apparently, I will never again lead a practice period at Tassajara because I'm not the abbot of Zen Center or a former abbot of Zen Center, and only abbots or former abbots of Zen Center can lead practice periods at Tassajara. And they tell me I can't be abbot of Zen Center because I don't like meetings. And I keep trying to tell them I don't like dysfunctional meetings. I like meetings that function. Sorry. Anyway, I was the leader, the tanto, the practice leader for the practice period, the winter practice period in 1984. We had 22 students. I have been sitting for 19 years. And you know, a lot of the 19 years is at least two periods of at least an hour and a half a day, and then in many of those days it's two periods in the morning, two periods in the evening, one before lunch, and then plus the sesshins. You know, so I had done a lot of sitting. Many things happened at that practice period, but the story I want to tell you. We don't have time for all the stories, you know, that's why one writes books and things. But one morning and as the leader, then you get up, and in the morning, everyone's going to the Zendo, and then at the beginning of the third round of the Han, you go with your attendant, and you go to the different altars, the bathroom, the official bathroom altar, you go to the kitchen altar, you go to an altar for the gatehouse, and then you go to the Zendo. So I got up to the Zendo, and then the Han is rolling down as you walk along the gaitan there, the porch, and then into the Zendo, and then the roll down is finishing just as you step up to the bowing mat. You know, medium, soft, loud, bop, bop, bow. And you know, you're just right on schedule, right in the right place at the right time. It's pretty nice, you know, you've arrived. I arrived after, you know, 19 years. I'm in charge. I've advanced. Anyway, and then you do your three bows. You offer incense and then do your three bows at the bowing mat there, and there's a big bell, both the big bell, boong. And then you walk around the Zendo for the morning greeting. You must do that here, for early in the morning. Teacher walks around, and when you're sitting facing the wall, then when the teacher goes by, you put your hands up and go, show. Morning greeting, and I come around and bow at the bowing mat, and then facing my seat away from my seat, and then I sit down. And like before the lecture here, you've got to get... I tell people, you know, being a Zen priest is cloth management. You may not want to be so fast to get into this. And you realize how much cloth management is involved in it. But, so I sit down and I get everything in place. And I still do this, you know, what I was taught. Rather than just you plop down and like, I'm going to meditate. No, we sit, you know, from the Japanese teachers, you've got to get your... seat. You've got to establish your, help your hips find their stability, you know, so that when your hips are stable then and grounded, then you can grow tall inside, right up to the crown of your head and beyond. And I started sitting and I thought, what do I work on today? Should I follow my breath, count my breath, Should I note my breath? Should I practice concentration? Compassion? Mindfulness? What should I focus on to move forward in my practice? And I heard this little voice that said, why don't you touch what's inside with some warmth and kindness? And before I could even decide anything, my face was just full of tears and they were dripping down onto my robe. I didn't even have to say, okay, I'll do that. And I didn't have to know where that voice came from or where. And once I was, and then I was sitting there, and then the tears just, I wasn't exactly crying, but my face had just flooded without having to cry. And then the little voice said, it's about time. It had been 19 years. So after that, when I got to sitting, I'd go like, okay, I'll feel what's inside. And apparently, you know, it's interesting, but I had some sense of a lot of emotions, a lot of feelings, a lot of things. You know, you can't sit for 19 years and not know something about concentration and compassion and anger and rage and fear and terror and dread and sadness and sorrow and, you know, you can't. I don't know, maybe you can, maybe some people can. But at some point, usually, you can't anymore. You feel things, you start to feel what's inside. So I'd felt a lot of what's inside, which I could certainly tell you about, but we're skipping a lot. Anyway, but there was something I hadn't been touching. This is another interesting point, because what are you supposed to be doing? Where did you come from? You know, where did I come from? What am I supposed to be doing? And, you know, is your job here to present a picture to the world of somebody who's accomplished and skillful and perfect? Or are you going to touch what's inside and heal? Acknowledge what's inside and let it pass through you and move through you so that the bigger energy of your life can also wash through. And that you can grow and become the person you came here to be. Because you don't just become the person you know you're here to be unless you aim to do that. And it's a shift from how do I look to everybody and how do I look to myself and am I getting somewhere or not getting somewhere to can I just feel what's inside. So about a month after that, Katagiri Roshi visited. He was the interim abbot. And Katagiri Roshi would always sit quite straight. So I said to him in Doksan, Katagiri Roshi, in Zazen now, I'm just touching what's inside. Is that okay? Is that Zen? Or is there something more Zen than that I should be doing? Or something else I should be doing in meditation that would help my practice move forward, my Zen practice move forward better? And Katagiri Roshi said, Ed, for 20 years I did the Zazen of Zen Master Dogen before I realized there was no such thing. And a little voice inside said, oh, right on schedule. I've been practicing for 19 years. People ask me, do you have to practice that long to get to that point? And I don't know that you do. Because, you know, both Katagiri Roshi was in the Japanese Navy training to be a kamikaze pilot, and the war ended. And he was trying to figure out what to do, and he ended up at a Zen monastery and went right into a sesshin. This is one of those ones where you only sit full lotus. And they would come around with a pole. And, you know, you can't see, am I sitting full lotus or not? So they just take the pole and jam it in here. And if it hits something, which would be my left shin, then they know you're not sitting full lotus. So, anyway, he kept at it. And I started Zen when I was 20. So it may be just that, you know, when you get to be 38, 39, 40, begins to occur to you, know, it maybe I could use an inner life. Maybe I could, you know, I could be more in touch with what's inside and do things from inside. You know, with my good heart, with my good intention, I could do something from inside rather than I could think about how I need to do this so that I look good. Or I look the way I'm supposed to look. Can I share something from inside? And can I connect with what's inside, and can I connect what's inside with what's outside? So so it may be we just, you know, I was 39. Katagiri Roshi apparently started when he was 19. He may have been about 39. But most of us begin to have a sense at some point, you know, I could use an inner life and not just be trying to do it the way you should. And the way that looks good and that people respect and admire. And it's actually quite challenging, I found. I was listening to some tapes today. You know, I listen sometimes to a woman named, many of you have probably heard of her, Brené Brown. And she tells about, you know, when she was first researching shame, she only talked to women. And women's shame revolves around, do I look good? Am I beautiful? Am I nice? You know, so on. And so one day she was finally, after 3 or 4 years of only talking to women about their shame and how it works, you know, and having the perfect body and spending a lot of time in you know, with cosmetics, what have you. Oh, I'm way over time, I'm sorry. We need to stop. All right, I'll finish up. It's 7:30. Anyway, men's shame, she finally, one day a man came up at one of her book signings, and she just signed books for the wife and 3 daughters. And he says, he's waiting, and the wife says to him, honey, let's go. And he says, no, I'd like to talk to her. She says, come on, let's go. And he says, no, I'm staying to talk. And finally she says, okay, I'm going to wait for you in the back. And then he says to Brené Brown, so why do you only talk about the shame that women have? Why don't you talk about men? And she says, well, I've only been studying women's shame, shame in women. And he says, that's convenient. And she says, what do you mean? And he says, because the shame that men have, we get shamed for it. You know, my wife and daughters who you just signed books for, they want me to ride a white horse and take care of everything. And they would rather see me dead than fall off my horse. That's right, I got it, I know, that's right. I'm supposed to be a Zen teacher. You're sad? You're scared? You're worried? You're anxious? What's wrong with you? I thought you were a Zen teacher. And it reminds me sometimes of my friend Maureen Stewart, who was a Roshi, you know, in Cambridge for many years, teacher in Cambridge. And she had a husband who was a professor at Vassar or somewhere, a women's college, and he would have affairs with his students. And she used to say, I'm tired of this. You know, I'm putting up with it now, but I won't always put up with this. And he would say, but Maureen, you're a Zen teacher. You should be more understanding. You should be more compassionate. You should be more loving and accepting and tolerant. What is your problem? I thought you were a Zen teacher. And finally she said, we're getting divorced. And he went through his litany, you know, you should be more this, that, because you're a Zen teacher. And she said, it's because I'm a Zen teacher, I know what I feel. And I'm getting a divorce. We're getting divorced. It's knowing for yourself what's what inside. She said, and this is where I stand. And this is the ground I stand on. It's my truth. And it doesn't mean that it's your picture of a Zen teacher. But anyway. I think I've probably talked enough tonight, so I really appreciate your being here. I really appreciate, very grateful for the opportunity to come and speak with you. I don't get down to Santa Cruz very much, but it's quite a pleasure for me to be here. The room, I'm, you know, more of a, what they call a intuitive rather than a sensate. Sensates walk into your room and, oh, look at that beautiful, the color of the walls, that's really great. I walk in the room and like, how does it feel? So it feels pretty sweet in here. So thank you for that. Some Zen centers, you walk in and right away it's like, oh my goodness, are my hands in the right place? Is it okay if I'm here? Am I following the rules enough? Closely enough? Which foot do I move next? Because it's what's going on in the room. And then you feel what's in the air, and then you feel like you're, you know, you better do it right or they're going to boot you. It doesn't matter if you've been practicing Zen for 50 years. You could get canned. So it feels... So I'm very, very impressed, actually. You know, it's rather, because it's so easy for Zen people to get, you see it a lot in Europe especially, because they practice Deshi Maharoshi's way. We just do Zazen. And then they walk around in Kenyan. It's pretty wild, anyway. Okay. Huh? I know, this is Santa Cruz, exactly. Yeah, so pretty sweet. So thank you for inviting me, and please study where you came from and what are you supposed to be doing. The supposed to is, you know, not from some outward perspective, but from inside. What did you come here to do, you know, in this life on earth? Because this is my feeling, and, you know, that we come here, we, you know. And in some way, you're, you know, even to be here tonight, this is part of your... Dogen says, if you want to practice Buddhism, you should first believe in Buddhism. To believe in Buddhism is to believe that your life from the start has been on the path, with all of its wrong turns, and dead ends, and mistakes and confusions. It's actually all part of your path, the Buddha way. Okay? So thank you for getting this far, and please continue. Well, only 5 minutes over, not bad.